We will now take our first question from Michael Huttner from J.P. Morgan. Please go ahead.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. I had a couple of questions. The first one, if you had 170% solvency and the first half net income was about 2.4 billion, now, and assuming that the second half is about the same, and that 170% is really the upper band, you could pay out 2.4 billion in divi, which would be about 5.3. Is that the, and given also that the 170% already accrues some dividend, is it out of order to suggest that the divi could rise quite strongly given these strong numbers? The other thing is, I was a little bit puzzled, and you might say it's a very detailed question. You've got slightly less exposure to equities, 11.5 from 11.9 billion, but the sensitivity in the P&L for a 30% drop has gone up from 700 million to 1.1 billion. That's on slide 73. I was a bit puzzled by that. And the last one is on motor in Germany. It seems that the combined ratio was 113% in second quarter, 107 in first quarter. And despite all the measures that's been discussed in the past 6 months, you know, fleets and the, you know, reorganization of the automotive sector and all that, it just seems to be getting worse. When could we expect, with some certainty, a turnaround here? Thank you.
Now, a couple of very good questions. Michael, hello on a Friday. Dividends, I know that's everybody's dream. Let's stick to what we've said, yeah, because the year is only half year over. We have said that we would like to maintain the dividend at least at the level of prior year. And we are, as always, accruing 40% of net income for dividend purposes. Now, I don't want to make any forecasts on dividends, but I'd like to tell you a little bit about capital, and I'd like to caution you a little bit around capital. As I said earlier, the solvency ratio is very strong, and we maintain it. We carry a very strong rating. But you also know that with dropping interest rates, the capital requirements on the life side are going up, not down. That's one observation. The second one, the rating agencies are applying more scrutiny. Their models are having higher charges for equity and other risks. So we also need to watch those boundary conditions, and we don't want to, in any shape or form, endanger a strong capital position across these criteria. So we look at that carefully, but as I said in the past, we will not retain capital that we don't apply for growth, right? So we're turning capital that we don't need to support our business, either in terms of stabilizing the balance sheet or supporting growth, we will return to shareholders. But I'm not ready to give you a precise number. The net equity exposure and the gearing you, by the way, have in the documents, it's 11.5, and it's across the various portfolios. So if there are more detailed numbers, Oliver Schmidt can give them to you, I think is not puzzling. Now, the German motor number is something that's bothering me as much as you do. What are we doing? The first one is we have a new management team on board, finally, that is going to address the issue. The new CEO, Markus Ries, is personally heading a review of the claim system. I think we need to dramatically improve our claims handling, and we are doing that. The market, however, is still soft and competition in a sense. There were rumors around price increases. We don't see them. Actually, I think it's marketing technique on behalf of some of the mutuals. The reality in the market is as tough as it has been. And for the next year, we're really trying to make sure that we don't get the results that we have seen. Now, on top, you need to differentiate MTPL and motor-owned damage. We had significant losses this year out of NatCat and motor-owned damage because of hailstorms and other weather-related events, which you please should also bear in mind, and that has hurt not just Allianz, but across the markets. AXAs have published very bad numbers on motor, TPL, and others, and also on Casco. So it remains a tough market and a tough environment. I don't see any short-term improvement in the market fundamentals because the excess capital position of the market is still very high.
Thank you.
We'll now take our next question from James Quinn from Citigroup. Please go ahead.
Yes, hello. Two questions, please. First one on P&C. Rates are up about 2%. I'm just wondering how much of that would you see as in the earned premium base for the first half, or is that more on a written basis?
Are you talking about the price increases, James? Sorry, Oliver here.
Yes, the price increases.
So your question is, how much of the price increase are we actually already seeing in the earnings space? And I can give you already the number according to the loss ratio development. It's 40 basis points.
Okay, so that's 40 basis points so far. And then the other question would be, to what extent is that 2% gross or net of expected claims inflation? Obviously, if it's gross, how much would you ordinarily expect to come back the other way in terms of claims cost?
We have claims inflation estimated always on an annual basis, and that is expected to be 2.5% for this year. That varies, however, across geographies and portfolio, and obviously has always an effect. Now, it's normal price increases, and that's why it's so tough to say what is going to be the true premium and bottom line effect, because we need to see what discounts have been applied. We're reining in on discounts wherever we can. But, for example, in Italy, where we have the Bersani laws, now agents can still give gift discounts and place business somewhere else if they don't like the discounts they're getting. So I can only tell you typically half a quarter later what the real impact is. And that's, by the way, why the nominal price increase forecast have come down, because now after 6 months we really see what has been achieved and is getting into the book.
So should we assume, I mean, if you're getting 2.2 price increases and claims inflation is 2.5%, I mean, is that net-net, that's basically about offsetting each other then? Is that a reasonable way of looking at it?
That basically means it should be flat. Now, the reality is we have achieved better results, as you can see, because the first thing is, and let's go through the slide, I think that's easily overlooked, that shows you the profitability walk of the combined ratio. And I'd like to go that is the page 17, because that's very important. When you say the forecast is that is obviously before all the efforts we're putting on managing frequency and severity down, which is something that has hit us in this crisis significantly. So as you can again see in the upper right-hand side, we had the 40 basis points of the price impact that was positive, but despite 2.5% claims inflation, which we pro rata have already accounted for, we had a reduction of 30 basis points net because of what we've done in frequency and severity and some of the large claims disappearing that we've recorded. Yeah. So the claims inflation is basically the fundamental driver, which has an overlay of nat cat and large claims. And then obviously how effectively we are managing claims, and that is what we are trying to do now, is balancing the fundamental claims inflation with high effectiveness, which is, by the way, in a number of units we didn't do so well the last 2 years. Yeah. And that's why I mentioned the German example. I think a significant part of the profit improvement in Germany have to come not from the market, but our own operations. And management, the new management, actually agrees with me here.
Okay. And also, just on asset management, even if we take out the 88 million of performance fees, it still looks like a very good number and far above what your guidance would have been on a sort of run rate basis that you set at the start of the year. I'm just wondering, I mean, is this simply a reflection of the fact that you've got an asset base that's going up because of low bond yields and that's feeding through to higher revenues? Or is there other factors at work? So, I mean, is there something in here which you might caution us about extrapolating?
The most important thing is AUM's up. So asset under management drives almost everything. But also we have changed product structures. Yeah, we have are moving from pure fund and that looks at return to more solution businesses that offer higher margins of two sorts. First, the gross margins are higher for these products, but the second one is they lock in performance fees earlier. So in difference to many competitors, our performance fees are actually earned. They're not forecasted and pro rata accounted for. They're actually earned in the book. That's a change from the past and provides a higher level of earnings quality. That is very important. And we are strengthening the move, particularly in fixed income, to move away from traditional products to solution businesses, which give us much better margins. Yeah, and you see that if you look at the profitability, what we call third-party AUM-driven margin, that has moved significantly up from 36 now to 39 bips, and we expect this trend to continue. So it's not just one-offs and only performance-related. It also reflects a change in the underlying products. Yeah, and that's better, and that was your real question. That is better than forecasted. That's true.
Right, okay. I guess, well, I'll let someone else ask a question. I'll come back to you later. Thank you.
Sure, James.
We'll now take our next question from William Hawkins from KBW. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much. I've got two questions. My first one, Oliver, with regards to your comments about life new business on slide 29, from separate analysis of your full year embedded value disclosure, Allianz does seem quite unusual in writing particularly capital-intensive new business on margins that are not necessarily particularly high. And that, to me, would be a concern if you're effectively saying that because of a low yield environment, there could be even more downward pressure on the margins, because it does seem that whilst your life business is stable, overall, what new business you're writing does appear to be consuming a lot of capital, not to generate a particularly high margin. So to the extent that that's a description that you recognize, could you comment on that and sort of comment on whether there's anything you can do about that or whether it's just what you're stuck with because of your business structure and low yields? And then my second question, thank you for flagging the 155% internal solvency ratio. I know that in the past, your embedded value that's fed into that number hasn't actually been identical to the embedded value that you've published. So particularly in times of stress, you've given yourself credit for liquidity or something like that. Is there any difference between the EV that's implicitly in the 155 and the EV you've told us? And if there is a difference, could you tell us what the 155 would be if you didn't include any adjustments?
Yeah. Let me start with the second question. Very good questions, Will, and good afternoon to you. The internal solvency is actually, and the MCEV numbers we're using are now the same between the two numbers. So there need to be no corrections. And that's, I think, very important and needs to stay. And as I said before, capital consumption has something to do with what products we have. Now, the way we deal with that is to lower the guarantees on the new business in order to deal with that. The other one is just the way we compute. Indifferent to other companies, we do write significant risk transfer business that we believe actually delivers good value for consumers or lower periods, longer periods of time, and we apply very conservative charges due to the long duration of the liabilities. I actually believe in some areas we are overly conservative, and I feel, and that's good to be overly conservative, and I feel we are delivering the right value for that. Now, it doesn't mean we're not looking at very long-dated options and prices and thinking about product design optimization, but we feel extremely comfortable because we write these products where we have the capital to support it, like we do that in Germany. Yeah? So that is very important. So we're not taking risks anywhere. We cannot afford that. Overall, I actually believe our new business margins are at least as good as the top peers in our universe.
Thanks, Oliver.
We'll now take our next question from Paul Goodhind from Redburn Partners. Please go ahead.
Yes, thanks. I had a couple of questions on the non-life business, please. Back to page 17 and the walkthrough of the accident year claims ratio and the frequency and severity component. To clarify, it sounds as though the reason why it's gone down, severity and frequency, is the dropout of one-offs rather than the underlying trends on claims being favourable. So you've got the absence of the large losses in France, and there were some, I think there were some weather losses in Germany last year that were not defined as nat cats that aren't there. So that's presumably distorting that number, and the underlying is therefore going to be up, presumably, you know, close to the 2.5% that you mentioned, and therefore, you know, there is no positive gap between pricing and claims inflation on a normalised basis. Is that a correct summary? And if that's the case, you know, what can you do about that? Because obviously you want to get some improvement in the profitability of the business. And the second question, which is kind of related to that, is am I correct in hearing you say earlier, Oliver, on the call, that you were being more cautious about the outlook for next year in terms of pricing? Does that mean that the kind of 2.6% for this year that you're looking at or hoping to achieve, that you might not achieve that next year?
Let me start again, Paul, and good afternoon to you with the second question. I'm actually more positive on next year. I think we're seeing the trough of the cycle, and it's going to go up, but I'd like to bank on facts, not assessments and forecasts. Yeah? I'm not the crystal ball and then announce to you super price increases like I hear that in every other call, and they are not coming. Yeah, so what we are doing currently now, just to give you a little background, we are having very precise cycle analytics on what is the capital position in a respective market and submarket, And what is the net cash flow development in these markets? Because we know that cycles will only turn if operating cash flow gets under pressure. And as long as companies have lots of money coming out of their ears, they will burn the capital. Now, low interest rates will provide pressure. But again, the number of countries, particularly France and Germany on the motor side, have huge amounts of excess capital, and we are observing that. So our forecasts on prices are actually reflected in analytics of the cycle and competitive behavior, because if you have more listed companies, they will behave more rational than non-listed or mutual companies, by and large. So it's the first answer on the pricing forecast. But again, the summary is 2011 should see more positive effects across our portfolio than 2010. Now, on the large frequency, yeah, it's very interesting that you say that because I see it much more positively. The reason why I'm saying I see it much more positively than you is the following. I think we are delivering very, very good results despite the fact that we in five large markets had over the last 18 months very significant challenges. And a significant component of those challenges were actually homemade. Yeah, so we had integration issues on top of the Bersani laws in Italy, and we have issues with restructuring in Germany and some underwriting issues. And it's very important that we get these out of the picture. So sustainable profitability improvements, of course, also mean we improve our own operations more significantly, and that means we are under control of our own destiny and don't have to depend on the market. So in my assessment of the situation, I'm a little more positive. We will have the claims inflation, but getting the large claims and the claims effectiveness measures underway and addressed will improve our claims ratio going forward. And if we get the benefits of the price increases, our profitability should substantially improve.
Great, thanks a lot.
And that is at a very high level, by the way.
Yep.
We'll now take our next question from Michael Hayes from Cheuvreux. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon.
Hi, Michael.
Three questions. First, with respect to the low interest rate environment, P&C recurring investment income.
Yeah.
If I am correct, then your target is for 2010 to achieve a recurring investment income after interest expenses and investment expenses of around about 3.2 billion. Can you tell us how this is going to develop going forward to 2011, it seems to me that you are quite protected against the lower interest rate environment. Second, in the conference call with journalists, you mentioned that you target for 2010 still a combined ratio of 97 or better. This implies a combined ratio of, I don't know, it's 95 point something in the second half. How is it possible to achieve? What runoff profits can we assume or should we assume for the second half? And my last question on Allianz Leben, also in the current low interest rate environment. Can you give us an idea to what extent your recurring investment income in Allianz Leben covers the guarantees granted to policyholders for 2010?
Yeah, we can do the last question. Let me hit one after the other. So I think what we've said is that for 2010, the estimated investment income, operating investment, is around 3.5 billion. Yeah, so that's a little above the 3.2 that you just mentioned. I said in the last quarter that we are stabilizing our investment income despite lower income because we want to grow the investment base, and I'd mentioned that earlier. So we're getting counter effects from growing the investment base, and we have all kinds, by the way, of measures underway and planned on making sure that we get the operating income. So, for example, managing receivables in-house and getting better returns on those.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the forecast of the combined ratio, what we exactly said was the question was you forecasted a better ratio than last year, which was 97.4. And the original answer to that is yes, but we had very high net cat loadings. So the forecast for the year will really depend on two major items and assuming that the cost development is in line with our plan. The first one is what will happen to net cat in the second half of the year after we had just very high loadings. Now, if we see a reversion to the mean, we should be looking very good in terms of overall combined ratio. And we will have some more runoff because the credit business will not just produce very high runoffs in the second quarter, but is expected to have more runoffs in the remainder of the year. I'm not ready to give you an exact forecast on that number, but let me put it differently, and I think that's very important for you because investment income also plays a role. We are sticking to our target that we've given ourselves of at least $4 billion in operating profit, and I think we should be able to achieve that. Again, that assumes we will not get major hits out of the hurricane season. Yeah, that is very important. And you pick your runoff number. The lower boundary was always 2% that Helmut has given that we have as a minimum priced in. The average over the last quarters were more between 3 and 3.5%. I'm not managing this number. We are really developing out of a well-reserved book, and so we should be able to achieve a strong second quarter.
In your assumption for 97 or better, do you assume a net cat load of 2%?
Yeah, that was the original assumption, and now we are higher than that, right? Which means for the remainder of the year, we need to below the average in order to get there. But that is not without reach. Yeah, we have another month of a hurricane in the U.S. So far, it is benign. Now, on your life question, we are earning around 5% out of interest and similar income, and the guaranteed rate is 3.3%, so we're very comfortable. I think we said that at the end of the year, we can sustain 18 years of a 1% environment because we have just a very, very strong capital position in Germany. Now, to be a little cynical, it doesn't really help much because before we have a problem, many other people will basically have a problem.
That is my concern as well. But with respect to the 5%, that is only recurring investment.
Yes, that is recurring investment income, interest and similar income.
And the 3.3 is the minimum guarantee, but you get
it's the average
more.
Guarantee. If the average guarantee of the book that is continuously coming down.
Yes, but the credit that you give for this year is higher than 3.3. It is 4 point something.
Of course. But we do this very cautiously. By the way, and last year we had, an interesting discussion, sorry for the digression, with our regulators because we said we're taking the crediting rates down. The only effect was that everybody else was giving more than Allianz, even though we're the only guys with the right balance sheet. So we are taking a very conservative stance on crediting rates.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
We'll now take our next question from Brian Shea from Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. I had two questions, please. First of all, Oliver, on the expense ratio slide in the non-life section, you passed over that quite quickly. I know in the past we've sometimes had long discussions about this. It seems to be in check now. But I just wondered, I think in the past you weren't happy with the level of 28%. I just wonder if you could comment, are there any actions in place now to get that expense ratio down to below the current run rate? And then secondly, you very kindly gave some comments about the outlook for two aspects of the life insurance profit, the expense spread and the technical spread. What about the investment spread? You're running at about $2 billion per year. I guess one would have thought with lower interest rates that it's got to be coming down in the second half of this year, 2011, and going forward. Could you comment on that, please?
Yeah. Brian, good afternoon. I have two answers. On the expense slide, it's a little bit like it's too good. What I'm trying to say is I hope we're seeing the emergence of a trend that we have been expecting for a while. But it's only one quarter, so I'd like to see the continuation of the number before we actually pop the cork on the champagne bottle. Right, so we're seeing the fundamentals improving. As you know, in the past, everything we saved on admin cost was spent in the crisis on maintaining distribution. Why? In P&C, as people are fighting for fewer and fewer clients, the marginal expense for maintaining your business and growing it goes significantly up. Also, because the cost-income ratio of the distributors suffers much more quickly from top-line reductions than the producers, and therefore we needed to support our distributors. Now, this picture now shows an improvement in the sense of we're actually focusing on that and getting that under control, and we get the admin expenses and other acquisition overheads in line. Again, it's too early to call it a success, but we're seeing the first signs of a stabilizing situation. Actually adjusted for foreign exchange is actually 88 million that were affected and should be deducted. So it's a net reduction, which is the first time in the long run. So that's, I think, fundamentally good news, but it's again, some sunshine doesn't create the summer yet.
It sounds like your aspiration is for stabilization rather than you guys have a target in mind.
We do have a target in mind, but we also want to be realistic because what is very important to be ready when the cycle turns. I think the benefits and the true success would be, let me define it, if we take the cycle turn up and we can keep stable expenses and really get scale. Now, it's very, very easy to bring costs down in a down cycle by just cutting staff, but doesn't really help you. What the success over time will be if we can grow without growing the cost base. Now, on the life and investment spread, we have two countervailing effects. Of course, lower interest rates are pricing themselves into the returns, but the asset base is growing, and it's growing much more than anticipated, and we're really looking at the net flows and the asset base grows, and that is supporting our investment income. So as long as the asset base grows, we will see at least stable, if not improving investment income. And that was not part of our original plan to grow the asset base as much.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, but we're not taking dramatically higher risk, if that is what your question is implying.
Thank you.
We'll now take our next question from James Shuck from Jefferies. Please go ahead.
Hello, Oliver. I have two questions, please. First one on just on capital. I know your Solvency I target range is to have a capital position between 150 and 170, and you're currently at 170. You're making the point on the internal capital that obviously low risk-free rates impact the level of surplus you have on that. So I'm just wondering, can you give us an actual target range on the internal capital metric, please? And my second point is just concerns traditional life products. Obviously, with a Solvency kind of II environment, I'm just questioning what the role of the traditional spread-based products is in this new world, because obviously you need to back a lot of those liabilities with corporate bonds, and the capital requirements on those corporate bonds are very high. And at the same time, there's a very much an asymmetric risk profile that I believe is penalized under Solvency II. So I'm just wondering what you think about the role of that product in the new world, please.
Very interesting questions. Now, the first one, we don't give a specific quota on the internal model. As you know, that we are moving the internal model into a Solvency II world, and we are in the middle of the process of doing that. And as you know, we are applying a lot of the same criteria, but very conservative, for example, diversifications, but we are also assuming in the internal model full fungibility of capital across businesses. Now, we will only find out over the next year and a half whether what the exact computations are that are being allowed under Solvency II. So I don't feel comfortable to give you a certain target ratio now that says if we reach that, we'll have that as it is in flux. Yeah, it doesn't mean we don't have precautionary notes if we see that in a particular segment, for example, capital ratios are getting tight. But we don't have an overall, this is the 170, and then we can do that. Again, because on top of that, we also have rating constraints that we are paying attention to. So we're managing a cockpit of capital boundaries and paying attention to that. Again, as I said, we are basically accumulating 40% of net income for dividend distribution, and we'll stick to that. And I'll also stick to the announcement that we will not bind capital that we don't need for growth or support of our balance sheet. Now, and we'll see where that is at the end of the year. Now, the second one is around the spread-based business. It's a little bit looking in the crystal ball, because you're right that if you outright apply credit spread charges to a certain business, then you would get to very, very high capital charges. But let me remind you of a couple of things, even though we're not through with the process. The first thing is we'll have a liquidity premium credit on this business that will have significant capital reduction aspects of it. And the second one is that people often don't understand is what is the policyholder participation in the credit spread risk. And that's very important, because up to a point, policyholders share a significant part or all of the credit risk in the portfolio, and therefore that needs to be borne in mind. For competitive reasons, I don't want to provide disclosure of what it is, but if you have an intelligence structuring of the products, you can actually continue to run credit spread-based products. But it assumes you do it in an intelligent way, and I'd like to keep it there. So I believe that you can run these businesses, but it's good that we are applying the right capital charges for something on an economic basis. Yeah, that will discipline. Now, if the markets in the various countries do not apply discipline, we will obviously take a look at it, whether at the right levels we can earn and create shareholder value, and then make a decision. But we believe we can make and structure these products to be very successful.
Thank you.
We will now take our next question from John Hocking from Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. I've just got a couple of questions on the runoff result, if I may. You mentioned credit as one of the driving factors behind the runoff result. Could you give us some idea, please, of the proportion that credit makes up of the 4.5%? And also, is there any sort of cyclical tailwind that should lead us to think that credit is actually going to make a reasonable contribution going forward? Thank you.
You said you had a couple of questions, so that was
no. Just sorry, it was really the two points on the runoff on the credit side.
Yeah, we have. If you look at the impact of credit on the development in the second quarter on page number 17, actually for this line is the only one we've explicitly mentioned. Is 70 basis points, just the improvements there. The loss ratio accident year was 23.3% improved because of an ongoing decline in claims frequency and severity. And the runoff stands at 32.7%. Right? So that gives you the precise numbers. We have runoff in France that was 4.2%. And we have had runoff in AGCS. I think that's very important to notice. That is, however, not at a material level. Given the overall portfolio. I don't want to disclose specific numbers across the portfolio because, number one, they vary all the time and they don't give you a good indication because they fluctuate. Some operations do have positive runoffs in one quarter and other have it in other quarters. So, for example, in a number of markets, the reserve committees meet in the second quarters and others only in the fourth quarter, for example, in Italy, and then the prior year development gets determined. So you cannot take a second quarter number and then prorate that across the portfolio.
Okay, thank you very much.
We'll now take our next question from Mark Thiel from UBS. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My first question is related to your second largest P&C market, Italy. Combined ratio seems to be moving into the right direction, and presumably the rate increases you've implemented will continue to feed through in the numbers. However, ISVAP, the regulator, has the intention to interfere in terms of the motor insurance business. Do you have any plans to sort of react to that? Would you be prepared to lose volume? That'll be my first question. Then the second question, again, on life insurance business and coming back to the strong growth in areas including guarantees such as Germany and Korea. When we model the operating earnings, would it be fair to assume a reduction in the percentage of the operating earnings compared with the account values? You were suggesting that the account values will be driving the investment income on an absolute basis, but relatively speaking, in terms of the percentage, would you agree that we should see some contraction?
The earned yield, you mean?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, but it's over longer periods of time because the duration, obviously, that we are running is a lot higher. Yeah, I think what the question is, if I understand it correctly, what's the marginal rate of return that we have on the assets flowing into the portfolio? Now, that obviously depends on the share of the new investments of the total portfolio, and it's less than 10% if you look at it this way. Right? So the very what really matters is what are the earnings that we have on the book, and they are around, as I said before, around 5% on interest and similar income, i.e., without any harvesting. So that means we have good returns that we can provide. The way, by the way, we are managing and protecting ourselves is we are changing crediting and product features in order to make sure we do one thing that's very important for us to grow the asset base, i.e. moving crediting rates to the end of the contract length, because that improves economics. But for various reasons, competitive reasons, I don't want to go into the details here. But trust me, we're really monitoring the economics of this very carefully in this environment. Now, on Italy, I have a couple of points. The first one is, as you said, year-on-year accident ratio has improved, 79.6 down to 78.5. And we have had very strong price increases at renewal for MTPL. And it's correct that you say the ISFAB doesn't like it, but let me be very blunt here. The industry from a economic capitalization point, by and large, is bust, except for us. We're taking more than 45% of industry profit at this point in time, and that's obviously unsustainable, not because we cannot be good anymore, but because the other guys have to improve. Yeah? And so they're dramatically increasing prices across the portfolio. We'll do less so. Now, we cannot exclude regulatory actions, of course, and then we would, of course, be willing to let business go if margins are not economic as we've done this, and we've been adjusting our cost base down accordingly. Yeah, so that means we need to continuously focus on cost. I, however, believe that we will see significant price increases because the economics just required. We have a much higher level of bodily injured claims payments because the Milan tables have just increased bodily injured claims average payments. That's decided by the Milan courts, and that's just reflecting economics, and they need to be paid for in terms of prices. The laws of physics hold. You cannot have low premiums and continuously have claims increase. So I believe that this has to improve. Now, on the other hand, we have some own homework to do. We had some large claims in property in the commercial book that we really need to address, and we're continuously cleaning the commercial portfolio as well. So it's not just all the market, also Allianz Italy has to do some homework going forward.
Thank you.
Can I take our next question from Nick Holmes from Nomura? Please go ahead.
Yes, hello there. I had a couple more questions on life, please. The first is, could you tell us a bit more about how vulnerable you think your life business outside Germany is to a prolonged low interest rate environment and what you're doing about it? And then the second question is, coming back to German life, is there scope to increase your shareholder participation ratio this year, and perhaps you could remind us where you are with the participation ratio that you're taking at the moment. Thank you.
Nick, how are you? Very happy to answer. Now, this is obviously, the first one is a very, very broad strategy question, so I hope you excuse that we're not giving all the measures we're doing and having them taped by our competitors. there are a couple of points. So, of course, we are exposed where we don't run unit-linked products. So the most important thing is that we're thinking about what is the right mix of unit-linked products, purely unit-linked versus products with guarantees. And how are these guarantees constructed? Are they actually based on hedged guarantees, where we can buy the hedges on the capital market, or where we're taking balance sheet risk? And we're trying to very carefully balance the margins on those that we're taking on the book. The more we can hedge them and refinance them, the better. The other aspect of it is we are combining capital market products with insurance products, giving customers the choice and incentivizing them, obviously, to choose the less pricey and the less costly guaranteed options. Now, the other thing that we're doing is to make sure that sales campaigns do not create artificial, are not supported by artificially high rates. So, for example, we have discontinuous campaigns that in the past has given consumers above market rates. The good news is, as banks, for example, have been reducing their crediting rates, that becomes competitively more easy. So, for example, in France, the Livret A account credit significantly went down. So the need to actually offer unreasonably high guarantees, even if it's only for a year, is disappearing. But the most important thing is what we've been discussing. Yeah, we are applying a very conservative methodology on calculating new business value and margin, and we're having very, very tight limits. So, for example, every product in Allianz that somebody is proposing to carry a negative new business margin, again, which is defined as having in a risk-free environment, i.e., excluding calculated returns on equities and other things that we would be betting on, has very tight limits. They need to be brought up to the group center, and Tom Wilson as the CRO and myself are looking at them, and they need to be granted to our group RICO. So it's very difficult in an Allianz environment to sell a product with a negative economic margin, and again, with very, very tight parameters. So this is how we are doing it.
Yes, that's
and the shareholder participation on Germany, as we are digging up the number, even our German CFO is looking, so we'll deliver to that you that later. But we are not worried about not getting enough return for the shareholders in Germany. As you know, that share has over the last few years gone up considerably, and I think is the benchmark in Germany.
Okay, can I just follow up very quickly on the answer to the first question? I mean, can you characterize in a sort of very simple and common sense perspective where you think there is the need to improve risk management for spread deficiency risk? I mean, common sense would suggest within your book it's probably in America. Would you basically say that's right?
Yeah, in America we have, remember, we have two types of main products that we're selling through AZ Life. That's the variable annuity business and the fixed index annuity. Fixed index annuity is about 2/3 of the assets, variable annuity is about 1/3. The variable annuity business is doing very well at the moment because the repricing in the market has happened, and so far we see significant discipline improvements. So, and the new business margin is comfortably around above 1.5 percentage point. Now, the fixed index annuity product will, in a low interest rate environment, become under pressure. That's why I mentioned the process earlier. And we are repricing the product to reflect positive new business margins. And that is what's going to happen. We are monitoring that very, very carefully. By the way, both on an accounting basis, where we are working to take the accounting volatility out through the market value liability option, and the true underlying economics to adjust the credit spread. But again, let me remind you what I said earlier. A significant part of the credit risk, both on defaults, on spread, is shared with a policyholder. We have a very low minimum guarantee of 1.7%, and the losses are borne by the policyholders up to a significant degree. So you have a significant hedge, so to speak, for shareholders on credit spread risk development that is very badly understood in the investment community. That's why I'm pointing it out. By the way, I now do have the answer for the policyholder participation in Germany. It's for, it's the segment, guys. For the segment, it's 86%, so it's not Germany, and it's 14% for the shareholder, and expected to be stable. And the German number, Oliver Schmidt is going to dig out, I'm absolutely sure.
That's very kind. Just one very, very quick last question. With the American back book, the fixed index annuity book, how much of that back book would you say is asset liability match for interest rate risk?
An interesting question, but we don't disclose ALM match numbers, Nick. I'm very
okay.
Sorry.
Great. No, thank you very much for what you said. Thank you.
We'll now take our next question from Julia Raffo from Autonomous Research. Please go ahead.
Apologies, but I haven't received yet the information with regard to the life MCV. So I don't know if what I'm asking is in there, but I would appreciate if you could detail us what has been the movement of the PVFP as opposed to the life MCV, and if you can give us a sense for where it was, the off-balance sheet PVFP at the end of June. And my second question...
The end of June number, let me do it very quickly, was 3.7, i.e. the shareholder value not accounted for. What I propose, because we have provided these numbers and I want to keep everybody focused here, we provide the numbers through IR. They have distributed MCV and all the movements. I just would like to keep this afternoon very focused and on numbers we have not distributed yet. Yeah, I hope you don't take it as an offense, but the numbers are well documented in our...
It's just I think by mistake I didn't get it, so that's why I ask. My second question is on the new business value and on the new business margin. Can you please just clarify and confirm, am I right in thinking that the new business value that you show for Q2, is that calculated with the financial market assumption as per the end of June, which is to say the VIX, the volatility on the swap option, and the interest rates where they stood at the end of June?
No, we do that always beginning of the quarter, and that migrates through the portfolio. And we do that every quarter with the quarterly number.
So that would be with the markets as per the beginning of April?
Yes.
And do you have in a position to say what would have been the number had you calculated with the end of quarter financial markets?
Yeah, the number would be lower, but, you know, don't get me wrong here. I'm not running parallel spreadsheets, okay? So what I propose we do, if you have questions like this on the sensitivities, please pretty give them to Oliver Schmidt and his team. They can provide you with all of the mechanics that you wish for.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Can we move on of the key core issues that you might have on the second quarter, please?
Yes, I just have my final question, just a follow-up on what Michael asked at the start about solvency. Am I right in thinking that in falling interest rates, given that the solvency one doesn't fully capture the greater risk, you would be temporarily prepared to sit on a solvency one higher than 170?
Yeah, if I think it's a very good question now. Now, that is a very good question. That's exactly right. Solvency one does not reflect unrealized gains and losses on the bond side as one, and it has thus very little sensitivity to interest rates, which is the key driver of economics and risk capital in this environment. Yeah? The first observation, and therefore we have the internal model and the rate. Some of the ratings that we see out there are also more sensitive to interest rate, and therefore you see more scrutiny from the rating agency. Yes, we would be prepared, if it's not appropriately reflected, to sit, if you want to say so, on higher levels of solvency if we've deemed that to be required to balance the underlying risk, particularly on the life book.
All right. Thank you very much.
We'll now take our last question from Johann Schmidt from Metzler Equities. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Just two questions, please. Firstly, could you provide a brief update on your internet distribution strategy in Germany, also against the background of the current competition in German motor? And secondly, very quickly, what stands behind the increase in minority income in P&C in Q2? Is this basically the increase due to credit insurance? Thank you.
Yeah, the resounding answer to your second question is yes. Yeah, it's because improvements there. I think that's very important. Direct strategy, longer conversation on that. Since I mentioned earlier with regards to General Lloyd in Italy, we're growing almost 20% year on year. That's a good question. We have recently decided that in the group center we have a unit set up called Allianz Global Direct that would coordinate all the direct activities now across the groups. And the new management team in Germany is developing a bottom-up new direct strategy that we will discuss at the end of this year in our planning dialogues.
Okay, thank you.
So, ladies and gentlemen, any more questions out there? If that is not the case, I'd like to thank you very much for your participation and your support. I think we had had a very good and very focused session. For those that are going on vacation, I wish you all the best for a great summer in Munich. It's raining, even though I like Munich, I'm very happy to disappear now. And I'd like to see you all back in the fall in good spirits and keep on supporting Allianz. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.